Before she was a producer for Women's Magazine, Kate Raphael was a volunteer in Palestine with the International Women's Peace Service. She spent a total of 18 months in Palestine between 2002 and 2005 supporting Palestinian nonviolent resistance to occupation and documenting human rights abuses. Kate has just released a novel set in Palestine, Murder Under the Bridge, the first English-language mystery featuring a Palestinian woman police detective, and this book has received a starred review in the Library Journal. Coming up in this segment, Nina Serrano, producer of Poet to Poet and La Raza Chronicles, talks with Kate about the evolution of this unique story.
I'm your host producer, Nina Serrano. My guest today is KPFA's very own women's magazine program producer, Kate Raphael. Today, the political activist and radio host is here as the author of a hot new mystery novel, Murder Under the Bridge, a Palestine mystery. I'll tiptoe through this interview, trying to avoid spoiling this gripping, revealing, and insightful book by not revealing who done it. Welcome, Kate Raphael.
Thank you, Nina. It's so great to be here.
Kate, I learned so much, and not all of it very pleasant, about Palestine as an occupied state reading your book. How did you gather all that information? What was the journey that led you to write this marvelous book?
Well, in 2002, the Intifada, the second Palestinian uprising, or what they call the second uprising. Some people would say that they've never stopped having uprisings, but what they call the second Intifada had been continuing for a little over a year. And things were really bad. I was reading a lot about demonstrations of Palestinians and nonviolent protests being attacked viciously by the Israeli army. And there was starting to be a call out for foreigners to go and put our bodies in the way, but also observe and learn about what was going on and come back and tell the stories of why Palestinians are in revolt and, you know, who are they, especially because the U.S., the narrative in the U.S. media is so controlled by the U.S. alliance with the Israeli government and all the vast amounts of foreign military aid that we give to the Israeli government. So I decided to participate in one of those campaigns. That was in April of 2002. I went for the first time. And I was there that time only a couple of weeks. But it happened to be during the siege of Bethlehem in April 2002. So, I mean, really what I saw was, first of all, the terror that especially the kids are living with on a daily basis of, you know, having shots being fired, curfews, not being able to go to school, not being able to walk around, not being able to go outside and play. And I really saw what that was doing to a lot of the kids, the trauma. And I also saw for the people, their parents, how hard they tried to protect their children, both physically and emotionally. And, you know, how serious they were about, one, wanting freedom and self-determination and wanting the right to either have their own country or have equal rights in a country that they were able to help determine how that country would be organized, a real democracy. You know, not everybody agreed on what they wanted, but they were unified in wanting to be able to help create that situation. And I got to know Palestinians for the first time one-on-one. I mean, I had certainly met individual Palestinians here. I had worked with Palestinian activists for some years off and on. But, you know, I got to know people living in the West Bank, and many of them knew that I was Jewish, and they were completely open to me and other Jewish activists as people that, you know, I knew this, but I really saw firsthand that this is not a religious conflict, that it's not some ancient hatred of the Jewish people, but, you know, that it's really just about land and about rights and freedom, like any human rights and civil rights struggle. So I decided I wanted to be there for a longer time, and I got that opportunity in 2003, I joined a program called the International Women's Peace Service, which was a project that spun off from the International Solidarity Movement, which people are probably familiar with. That was the group that Rachel Corrie was with when she so tragically was run over by the bulldozer. And so I joined International Women's Peace Service, which was a group of initially 16 women who each committed to spend 3 months per year in Palestine for 3 years. 3 months was the term of a IWPS long-term volunteer because 3 months is the length of the tourist visa that you can get at the airport. As an American or a Western European, you can pretty much get a visa with few questions asked, although, you know, increasingly that isn't always the case. It's not always so easy if they know or suspect that you're an activist. But most of us were able to get in at least that first time with no trouble. So I went for 3 months. And when I came back after my first 3 months, that was in January of 2003, I felt that it hadn't really been long enough. I had just started to really learn what the situation was about, to learn the language some. I mean, you know, I had gone speaking no Arabic. I had made a little bit of progress in picking up some Arabic. But I decided I wanted to spend a longer time the next time. I wanted to really learn to speak more Arabic. So between my first time and my second, I took some Arabic lessons. I went back speaking more. And that time I stayed for 6 months, at the end of which I was arrested at a demonstration in the village of Budrus, which people might know because of the film Budrus, the wonderful film by Just Vision, which documents the nonviolent resistance in that village to the construction of the apartheid wall. So I was arrested at that demonstration. I was in prison for about 8 or 9 days, I guess, and then I was released, but I had to leave the country. And
I noticed that that happens to your character as well, your protagonist, one of your protagonists.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I should tell that, although in point of fact, I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. Some of what happens in these books is certainly based on my experience. So what happened was that I came back to the States and then I managed to find a way to go back one last time. I went back for the last time in April of 2004. And I was there until I was finally deported by the Israelis in January of 2005. So now I really can't go back. So that time I was there for almost 9 months. My character, Chloe, the American character, who's of course not like anyone that any of us might know, she has been there 9 months at the time that this book begins. So she is sort of standing in for me a little bit, although people seem to find her kind of annoying. So I've been saying that she's really not based on me. But really what happened, I had never been a journal writer before I went to Palestine, but I was having very intense experiences day after day. You know, you couldn't spend all your time in the house. We were busy. We couldn't spend all our time processing what was happening. So I did a lot of writing. And some of what I wrote, I sent back as letters to my friends and people here who signed up for my email list who wanted to know what was going on, some of whom shared my passion for Palestinian liberation, some of whom completely disagreed with it but were willing to read it because they were my family or knew people who I knew, and some of whom I think were really learning about the situation. So that was very rewarding, but it only went so far. And, I mean, every Palestinian that you meet, when you're doing human rights work in Palestine, the number one thing that people say to you is, go back and tell the world about our suffering, tell our stories, get the U.S. government to stop funding the Israeli government. When I first went, I had this idea that I could just write these letters home and people would see the truth and they would find out what Palestinians are really like and they would change how they thought about our relationship with Israel. And the longer I was there, the more I realized that that wasn't going to happen on the basis of activists coming back and telling stories to the people that we know. You know, I felt that we needed to infiltrate more into the popular culture. And you're not going to do that with even the best written journal of an activist. And I'm not going to say that mine would have been the best written, but there certainly have been some beautifully written ones. Anna Baltzer's Witness in Palestine, Rachel Corrie's journals, which were posthumously published. You know, there have been some really moving things written, and, you know, movies like Five Broken Cameras. You know, I've been an avid mystery reader. I like the genre. I don't have that great of an attention span for reading, and so I find the pace of mysteries really works for me. And also, interestingly, it is a genre that often lends itself to a critique of things as they are, which is ironic because people think of the mystery genre as, you know, kind of law and order, and a lot of mystery novels have police as protagonists, as I do. I have a Palestinian policewoman who's a protagonist.
Well, why don't you introduce us to that protagonist by reading us some from your work?
Okay. As I was driving around one night with some friends, I glimpsed a scene which I didn't really know what it was, but it looked to be an abandoned car on top of a bridge, or actually on a settler highway that runs over a Palestinian village. So you have these settler roads that Palestinians are not allowed on, and then you have the old Palestinian roads underneath. And I thought, well, this would be a great place for a mystery to start. So I started writing, and I thought, well, you know, who would be in a mystery like this? And the first character that came into my mind was this Palestinian policewoman, Rania.
Please read to us from Murder Under the Bridge, A Palestine Mystery by Kate Raphael.
There is a situation in Azawiya, Captain Mustafa said. His roly-poly frame spilled out of his overstuffed leather chair. What kind of situation? Asked Rania. One requiring great tact. Rania knew the captain well enough to take this as a warning, not a compliment. She wasn't known for her tact. Captain Mustafa cleared his throat. Suddenly self-conscious, Rania removed her headscarf. The men were still learning to accept her in this job. Traditionally, women were nurses, engineers, and teachers. More recently, a few were doctors. Women as police detectives was a new concept. Wearing the hijab made the men she worked with feel like they were talking to one of their sisters or cousins. Taking it off made it possible for them to treat her like a colleague. A car is abandoned on top of the bridge, Captain Mustafa said. A Palestinian car? Yellow plates, he answered. An Israeli car on an Israeli road. Why should the Palestinian police care about that? The Yahud say that the car is stolen, her boss continued. The Jesh have closed the road under the bridge, and no one can pass on foot or by car. Rania understood now why she was being sent on this errand. If the Israeli army had closed the road between Masa and Azawiya, it would be necessary to find another way to approach, and she knew the land. Masa was her adopted home, her husband's village. She would know many of the people waiting to pass the roadblock, and she would have a plausible excuse for being there. A woman could surreptitiously gather information, while a Palestinian man moving around an army roadblock asking questions would not last long. The captain hoped she could find out who did what with that stolen car before the army did. She would deliver if it killed her.
And so the book continues. And we finally do find out why there was a car up there. But in the meantime, for me, there was all this new information about life in occupied Palestine. The idea that there would be two separate roads. The idea that that there would be two separate police departments dealing with the same problem. And they're skirting around each other, not even working in unison. And then as the book continues, another character gets introduced.
And that would be Chloe, the Jewish American woman who, you know, has a big attitude. She's very bold and fearless, but I think one of the things that binds her and Rania, or one of the things that draws them to each other, is that neither of them is tactful. As I, you know, said in that first, as in that first exchange, we learn that Rania's not known for her tact. Chloe is definitely her match in the no tact department. But they like each other. They recognize one another as sort of kindred spirits in that they both have a very keen sense of justice. The murder turns out to be of a foreign woman, a young foreign woman who has been trafficked into Israel, which was something that I learned quite a lot about during my time in Israeli prison, immigration prison, because most of my fellow inmates were foreign workers. Many of them had been trafficked in one form or another, and we could talk some about what that means.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, trafficking is something that gets a lot of attention now, and it has a lot of meanings. Usually when people talk about trafficking, they're talking about sex trafficking, which can be internal or external. So, you know, there are trafficked women in Oakland who are mostly girls, and they're sort of lured into being used for sex through often false promises, sometimes through force. In the case of foreign women being trafficked or men being trafficked, usually the form that it takes is that people are promised that they'll get a good job, that if they sign up with a certain company or a certain individual, that they'll get a really good job in another country and make a lot of money to send home. And then what turns out to be the case is that the job is either not what they signed on for, or they don't have freedom of movement. They're not able to leave the job. The working conditions can be terrible. And this can be true whether it's sex work or domestic work. I would say that of the women I was in prison with, perhaps 2/3 had been doing some form of domestic work, and maybe 1/3 were sex workers or prostitutes or in other ways being directly sexually exploited. But I would say that, you know, all of them were being exploited because of gender issues. The Chinese women were mostly working for Chinese men in restaurants or laundries. There were some factory workers. There were some agricultural workers. So it's a very complicated issue. But as I was in prison, I was thinking about this mystery. So, you know, you're very bored in prison. You have nothing to do all day. So I couldn't write much, but I did do a lot of thinking about the mystery. And one of the things I had been puzzling on was who should the person be who was killed? Should it be a Palestinian? I didn't want it to be an Israeli because I feel like the stereotype is that Israelis are always being killed by Palestinians. I mean, even more so right now, given what's going on. So I definitely didn't want an Israeli being killed on Palestinian land, even if it turned out that the Israelis had done the killing or something. And I felt like, well, if it was a Palestinian who was killed on Palestinian land, then there might not be so much reason for the Israelis to get involved. So then I'm sitting in prison and I'm surrounded by all these foreign workers and I'm thinking, oh, well, what if the person who's killed is a foreign worker? And that's how I came up with Nadia, the murder victim. Ultimately, this young man is charged with the killing and he's Palestinian. He was having a relationship with the young woman who was killed. And he is a friend of Chloe's. She lives with his family. So she wants to free him because she knows him. And Rania just doesn't want a Palestinian to be – Rania just doesn't think he's guilty, actually. She doesn't want it to be a Palestinian, but she also doesn't think he's guilty. And so they bond in trying to prove his innocence.
One of the things I noticed in reading the book was that it was very sexy. In fact, I was telling my friend that this was the first time that I'd ever read anything about lesbian sex that actually was sexy. Can you talk about that element?
Yeah, you know, that was something I thought about. Because when I thought, well, who would read this book? I mean, I felt like who I'm most likely to appeal to are going to be feminist lesbians. It's de rigueur to have at least a sex scene or to have some sex. And at the same time, you know, I felt that a natural audience would be people who are interested in the Middle East and in Palestine. And some of those people are likely to be religious in one form or another and maybe be pretty shocked by explicit lesbian sex. The other problem that I confronted is that I have read a lot of these lesbian mysteries, and a lot of them were very good as mysteries and I thought had terrible sex. Because, you know, mystery writing is different from erotic writing. And one thing that was wonderful was that a good friend of mine, Nomi Azriel, was an advisor on this book. She's an Israeli. She grew up in a settlement. There's a character, probably my favorite character in the book, is a 13-year-old girl, Malka, who's the daughter of a very powerful military man who lives in a settlement. And Nadia, the woman who was killed, worked for their family. So Nomi basically told me all about her life growing up, and I just stole it, and except that she gave me permission, so I guess borrowed it and put it in the book as Malka's character. But Nomi Azriel is also an erotica writer. She's a really wonderful writer. So she was one of my early readers, and she did double duty of correcting the Hebrew, giving me some advice about the geography, and she also critiqued the sex. And what she told me was stay with the emotions. Like, don't get too bogged down into what goes where, but, you know, talk about what the characters are feeling. And I think that was great advice.
Well, it worked. So it was great advice. So how can people get this book?
Well, I mean, the easiest way for people to find out all of their options is to go to my website, katerafael.com. My launch and book celebration will be November 19th at La Peña in Berkeley. That's hosted by and a benefit for Middle East Children's Alliance. So, you know, I would love it if people would go to that and buy it there, because Mecca will get money from those sales. The next night, November 20th, Friday at 6 p.m., I'll be at Book Passage in the Ferry Building. So it'd be great to buy the book from them and, you know, support them. On December 3rd at Modern Times, I'm going to be participating with some other women in a conversation about trafficking. So that would be another opportunity. But you can also obviously, you know, buy the book on Amazon, which as much as we don't like it, I mean, selling books on Amazon is probably the number one way that an unknown author gets their name out there and gets their book to be known. So, you know, I don't totally discourage people from doing that either.
And that was Nina Serrano interviewing our very own Kate Raphael, who is also a journalist and author, about her debut novel. To learn more about Kate's upcoming events or to find out how you can get a copy of her book, you can visit her website at katerafael.com. And you're listening to the Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 or kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota.